But that was the goal. So Starliner was launched on an Atlas V rocket. That, like I said, it's 6:36 Eastern Standard Time, Friday morning. So it was dark in Florida. They launched from Launch Complex 41. You know, they've taken over Launch Complex 41. You know, they built their tower next to the Launch Complex where they actually send the crew up. So they have a crew arm that comes out and meets the Starliner, which is all operational. They were able to put extra things, whatever they wanted, into the Starliner once they were ready to go on Friday. Able to close the hatch, duplicating a real flight. They wanted to see if they could launch a vehicle, have it dock autonomously, and come all the way back. Well, it got up, you know, it launched, first of all, launched on an Atlas V rocket. An Atlas V rocket has never launched a crew before, never mind a crew vehicle of any kind. So they have this all worked out over the last 8 or 9 years, put this on this very reliable rocket called the Atlas V rocket with a Russian RD-180 engine. Producing almost 900,000 pounds of thrust and sending this 25,000 pound, I think it's 27,000 pound vehicle into orbit. They had some changes that they made to the Atlas rocket to get this thing to orbit. They're using RD-180 engine that they've flown probably almost 100 times successfully, 100% success. So they're using that, and the second stage on the Atlas rocket is always the Centaur rocket. The Centaur rocket runs liquid hydrogen and liquid helium, and they get about 25,000 pounds of thrust out of it. But for the crew mission, what they want to do is they put two RL-10 Centaur rockets instead of one for the second stage. The reason for that is they need the thrust, you know, from the booster, and two solids. They also have two solid booster rockets attached to the thing to accelerate the vehicle, but not too fast. They don't want to. They don't. You know, if you have a crew in there, you don't want to go up to 8, 9. G's, you know, you want to keep it as low as possible, so to keep it at 3.5 G's, they run a low trajectory to orbit, and they have a high point, an apogee, of 150 miles or so, and then they have a perigee of like 40 miles. So in other words, if this thing gets, the first stage separates, the second stage separates, and the spacecraft gets into space, and you had a crew in there, and something went wrong, where all the rocket engines all of a sudden failed on the spacecraft itself, it would come back automatically and return to Earth. So, it would be an automatic abort. And then, what the normal flight would be is to, continue out, and then on the other side of the Earth, they'll light off the engines of the spacecraft itself, and that would put them into an orbital path, and eventually they would increase the altitude and get up to the International Space Station. That's the plan. Unfortunately, the plan didn't go that well. The Atlas V worked great. The RD-180 engines worked great. The two boosters that were attached to the Atlas solid boosters worked great. That separated. The second stage came on. First time that they ever had, a dual Centaur RL-1011 attached to an Atlas V rocket. They fired off great, no problem. They separated the spacecraft as they were going into orbit. That worked all perfectly. Perfectly well. Spacecraft was floating away from the second stage. The second stage goes up and eventually goes back down, and that deorbits into the ocean. But the spacecraft was supposed to, you know, shortly after that, fire some orbital maneuver thrusters to get itself into a circular orbit. But what happened on the way up, there's a timer, a mission elapsed timer that is inside the you know, when you have mission, you know, you get down to 5, 4, 3, 2, 0, 1. Starts the clock 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that's the mission elapsed time. For some reason, the mission elapsed time inside the spacecraft was set 11 hours later than what it was supposed to. So the spacecraft had no idea roughly where it was, or it thought it was somewhere else. So it kept firing its thrusters after it separated from the main rocket, trying to get itself to where it belonged. And it started to run out of fuel. They started to run very low on fuel, where they would not have enough fuel to make it to the space station. A couple of other things happened. The mission control tried to take over the spacecraft. They knew something was happening like that. They tried to take it over manually, but they were transitioning from one TDRS satellite to another. TDRS is a tracking data relay satellite, and you have one on the east, one on the west. You have three basic tracking data satellites that they use all the time. Because they were in a transition going from one to the other, they couldn't take it over quick enough, and they wound up losing all the fuel, or a lot of the fuel. And to make a long story short, these people realized that we're not going to get to the International Space Station. We'll be just happy to have a circular orbit, and that's what they did. Took control from the ground, reset the clock, and but they by that time it was too late. Too much fuel was gone, so they decided to abort that idea of going to the space station. And they had a news conference, and eventually they decided, well, we'll return the vehicle back to Earth. I heard another station. All right, go ahead. I thought I heard somebody comment. Okay. Nevertheless, the Starliner, as they call it, was stuck in circular orbit. All the thrusters worked. There's 60 different thrusters of various sizes all over the Starliner. The crew vehicle itself, plus the service module in the back, has all kinds of thrusters on it. And then they have abort engines in case they, four abort engines in case they needed that. They would fire it. That would pull them away from the vehicle if there was a problem. It's like 60 engines all over this vehicle. So they tested them all. They made sure everything worked. They figured, well, we're not going to make it to the space station. Let's make sure everything works. They pointed the tail end of the vehicle toward the sun. This thing is solar powered. They need solar power to charge their batteries. If you look at the back of the Starliner, back where the service module is, that back is covered with solar panels. So they pointed the vehicle in that direction. They know the recharging of the batteries works. That vehicle could fly pretty much 3 or 4 days by itself. The actual goal of the Starliner is to dock to the International Space Station, within a day, and then they power down and they hook themselves up to the International Space Station, and they'll actually sit in that configuration for up to maybe 4, 5, 6 months, and then eventually they would power it up, put the crew back on board Starliner and send them back to Earth, you know, after a 5 or 6 month visit to the space station. So, you know, but free flying, this thing could probably go 3, 4, 5 days, I guess. So now they decided, let's bring this thing back. They brought it back this morning, early this morning. And this Starliner is designed to land on land, not in the ocean. Remember all the Apollo missions, all the Gemini missions, all the Mercury missions, always landed in the water. Space shuttle, fine, that landed on the ground. You know, it had wheels and everything. This is a capsule design. This is, you know, it kind of looks like the Apollo spacecraft, but this one is much bigger. You know, you can put a crew of four in there comfortably. The diameter is bigger. It's taller. So, that's what they did. They, five different primary locations to land on land, and the primary one is White Sands, New Mexico, and that's what they did. They came down this morning. All three parachutes opened up. One of the tests that they had not too long ago, an abort test, they launched this Starliner spacecraft. It didn't go into orbit. It just, you know, it was duplicating going to orbit and duplicating an emergency, and the spacecraft separated from the booster. Everything worked fine, but when it came down, it only came down on two parachutes, which is acceptable. You know, if you had a crew in there, they wouldn't make it. They found out what went wrong, and they corrected that problem, and sure enough, on this flight, they came back from orbit with three chutes open, and you can see it coming down and landing in the middle of White Sands, New Mexico. So pretty interesting. They landed the vehicle, and they had all the support crew go out as if they had a crew on board. They kind of had somebody on board. It was a mannequin. They had mannequin named Rosie. They named the mannequin Rosie, and Rosie had all kinds of sensors and thermometers and everything all over the mannequin. So they were able to get out, open up the hatch, and go inside and check everything. And you know, this thing was in mint condition. They said, I mean, there was no marks on it whatsoever. They have the astronauts that would fly the next mission and the mission after that out in New Mexico to see this thing come back. There's going to be three astronauts that will go up probably the next mission. I don't think they're going to decide to run another test mission. I think they're just going to launch a crew to the space station. And they call that that's going to be a test flight too, because it will be the first time a crew is in the vehicle. So they plan to undocking with the space station, not staying that long, and eventually returning to Earth. And again, coming back and landing in New Mexico. It's really interesting when they come down with these parachutes. You know, the vehicle, the Starliner has a heat shield. You know, the heat shield, you know, takes a lot of the speed away from the 17,500 mile an hour orbit, and eventually the three parachutes come out, and as it comes down, the heat shield separates from the bottom, and just right before they hit the ground, they have these, as it's coming down, they inflate these six airbags. And they get inflated, and they completely surround the base of the... ground between the parachutes and the airbag. So it's like one picture I sent over to roy.ac2gs .com. If you look at that, you can see the vehicle sitting on the six airbags in the middle of New Mexico, and which is pretty interesting. And if you click on it, it blows up the picture, and you can see some detail of the spacecraft. So I thought that was pretty interesting. You had another astronaut out there, Sony Williams. She's been up there a number of times, to the space station itself on shuttle flights, and she will be flying the first operational mission. So it turns out this space vehicle that came back is reusable up to 10 different times. All the Starliners that go up will be reusable, and this one is going to be sent back up. So the next mission that goes up, they have another vehicle that's coming out of the factory down in Florida that will be going up on a test mission with a crew. Nicole Mann will be in it. Michael Finch and another guy, Ferguson. They'll be going up to the space station. But the following mission with Sony Williams, she's going to be going up. There'll be four people going up. Two people from NASA and two European Space Agency astronauts. But she'll be in command. So she'll be flying this same vehicle that just came back from orbit. They'll refurbish it, put the parachutes in it, put the new airbags in it. And she got to name it. It's a it's a private vehicle, really. It's owned by Boeing. It's not a NASA vehicle. So she's going to call it Calypso, named after the Jacques Cousteau Calypso. He used to go he used to float around the oceans. And Sonny Williams is a big. She's big on oceans. Comes out of the Navy, test pilot, astronaut. So this vehicle that came back now has the name Calypso, and that should be flying again probably sometime this year. Once the test mission is undertaken, this mission will this vehicle will fly again and again and again, like I said, up to 10 different times. If you had an exploded view of the Starliner from the very top, you have this ascent cover that eventually gets separated after it gets to orbit, and that's right on the nose of the vehicle. And that actually covers up the hatch that would eventually open up to the International Space Station. It's got a international docking collar below that. So it comes in nose first, docks with the space station. And that's how the crew would go in and out. And then off to the side of the vehicle, you have, near the top, you have the parachute compartment where you have your three main chutes and drogue chutes that come out that pull out the main chutes. A lot of people think, where's the parachutes? How could they be in the center? That's where the door is. The parachutes are always mounted to the side of the vehicle. That was the case, with Gemini and with Apollo. It's not really mounted in the center. Otherwise, you would never have a crew door be able to go through when you dock with something. Then you have a side door on the vehicle where that's where they get in. The crew access arm comes out on Launch Complex 41 and allows the crew to enter through the side hatch. And of course, you have your landing airbags on the bottom of that vehicle, part of that vehicle. And then below that, you have your big base heat shield that's around 15 and a half foot diameter heat shield. Which, that actually eventually separates too, right before you hit the ground, like I said before. And below that, you have your service module. The service module has all your fuel and extra supplies of oxygen, electricity, which feeds the crew module. Service module, of course, separates before the main capsule enters the atmosphere. And below that, you have your abort engines. They're very powerful. I mean, if you add up all four abort engines, it comes out to like 140,000 pounds of thrust or something. You know, like twice the amount of thrust that launched the first astronaut to a suborbital flight on a Redstone rocket named Alan Shepard. And below all of that, if you look at the very back of it, you see the all the solar panels. They don't have solar panels coming out on the side like you would see on a Soyuz Russian rocket. These are all at the very bottom of the spacecraft, and that's why once they do get to orbit, they orient the vehicle so that the tail end faces the sun. This way they're able to recharge their batteries. So that's the story on that, now called Calypso. It will be launched again. Any questions or comments about this topic? This is WS2M.
They're like turtles.
I heard one station, the call letter. I heard. Another spacecraft went up last week, not by the U.S., but by the European Space Agency. It's a telescope, a space telescope called CHEOPS, C-H-E-O-P-S. And that's an acronym for Characteristicing Exoplanet Satellite. So it's essentially very similar to a Kepler or a test space telescope. Kepler and TESS, they operate by looking at the light coming from all the different stars. And if the stars dim out a little bit, that's the planet going in front of it. All these things are so sensitive they could detect that. Kepler proved that. They've discovered thousands of planets with Kepler, and now TESS is doing the same thing. TESS completely different orbit than what Kepler was in. Kepler was in a solar orbit, you know, following Earth all the way around the sun as it went, where TESS is in an orbit going out to around the moon, around the moon location, even though the moon's not there, 255,000 miles out, and then eventually comes back toward Earth and at an apogee of around 60,000 miles, sends all its telemetry and pictures back from its trip out to the moon, and then that occurs every 14 days. So that's what TESS is doing. Kepler looked for thousands of exoplanets and found them. TESS is taking it one step further and looking at closer stars, you know, a couple hundred light years away from Earth, and looking at the closer planets from its orbit as it goes around. This is WS2N, and that's what TESS's story is. Now, this is CHEOPS, is another orbit that's different. It's just maybe 400 to 500 miles up from the Earth in a circular orbit, following the twilight zone area, you know, where the gray area between darkness and light, where and the sun sinking its orbit. So, you know, one side is always going to be picking up the sun, the solar panels, and the other side is always going to be looking at dark sky. And the idea of the European Space Agency, TEOP's mission, is to look at known exoplanets. So, you know, you have tests finding all these planets, and this thing will look at them with even more sensitive detectors and try to detect the actual diameters or radiuses of these planets that are going around for more accurate information. And that information will be eventually used by other ground space telescopes, like this, maybe this 30-meter one that can't be built in Hawaii, or the James Webb Space Telescope, which will launch in a couple of years. And then James Webb will be able to more accurately tell what kind of atmospheres might be in these exoplanets. But to do that, they launched this 600-pound-plus space telescope on a Soyuz rocket. When I say Soyuz, you think, well, it's a Russian rocket. Well, the Russians sold these rockets to the European Space Agency. They buy them, and they launched them, not from Russia, but they launched them from South America, from Kourou, French Guiana. So that's where they launched all their rockets. They have a Vega rocket that they launch from that location, which is the lighter payloads, and then they launch with the Soyuz that gives them a medium weight payload, and then they have the Ariane 5 rocket for the heavy payloads, soon to be followed by the Ariane 6, probably within another year or so. So this one went on a Soyuz that European Space Agency buys from Russia, and they launched it from there, and it successfully went to orbit. It actually had a couple of payloads on it. It had five, really. It had a heavier payload from Italy, a radar detecting satellite, and then below that was this TEOP's exoplanet detector that was set behind it as a secondary payload. And then they had three CubeSats that also went up. That's it. It didn't get that much press, even in the websites that you go to, but they've been planning this for quite a few years. It's actually put together in a different country. I think Spain was involved. So that's it. Any questions or comments on the space telescope, this WS2N? Nothing heard. And I don't have all that much. I want to comment about Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is another private company. It's owned by another rich guy named Peter Beck. Been developing the Electron rocket for some amount of years now, and I think he's only been launching like 2 years. I think he's up to his 10th launch. He launches out of the North Island of New Zealand. Originally, Peter Beck is from New Zealand, but it turns out this company, Rocket Lab, is registered in the United States, and they build their rocket engines in California, and I believe they build the rocket itself in New Zealand. And they reassemble everything there. And he's been launching these smaller to medium payloads, you know, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 pound satellites from there. Sometimes he launches multiple small satellites. And he has a big manifest to go through. And he wants to be able to launch, you know, his goal is to eventually launch once a week. You know, he's done 10, I think, in a year and a half. So he plans on accelerating. we've got a couple of ways of doing it. One way is to have these vehicles recovered. He's already gone, you know, the first 10 now have gone up without being recovered. But now the next couple is getting telemetry from them as they come down through the atmosphere. Plans on eventually catching them, catching the boosters anyway, with a helicopter and bringing it to a ship out in the ocean. And then bringing them back, refurbish them, and launch them again. They've got these Rutherford engines, and Rutherford is liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen, but they use these electric motors to run these turbines to pump the fuel through the engine. So each rocket has 9 engines for the first stage. Of course, it has 1 engine for a second stage, but 9 engines all light off, you know, when it takes off. That means it's got 9 individual pumps that are being driven by electric motors instead of, you know, the exhaust or something from the combustion system itself. He's actually running these turbos from an electric motor. In turn, each one is hooked up to these lithium batteries, and he's running like 50 horsepower motors to do each one. So he's going to be able to resave all these Rutherford engines and all these batteries and all these motors that are involved in launching the Electron rocket. That's what he calls it, the Electron rocket. But that's not going to be good enough. You know, he's going to be able to increase the amount of rockets by doing this because he won't have to build as many. But if he wants to get to his goal of launching, you know, one per week, he decided, well, let me build another launch complex. So he just completed one in the United States, in Virginia. In Wallops Island. Wallops Island is the location where Northrop Grumman now launches the Antares rocket, as well as the Minotaur rocket. But Antares rocket is the one that launches the Cygnus cargo vehicle on top, which goes to the International Space Station. So he took another area from the Wallops Island launch complex. He's building his own launch complex. He just finished building it, and they just had, you know, a ribbon cutting ceremony the other day. The second he finished that, the word went out. Okay, now I have 2 launch complexes. He wants to make it 3, so he's got the one down in New Zealand on the North Island that he's launched 10 successful launches so far, and now next to that launch complex, he's now starting to build another one. So between the 3, he hopes to eventually get to his goal of averaging 1 launch per week of the Electron rocket, and having them recovered as well. So he's pretty good for the environment. I like this guy, Peter Beck. And he apparently has the sales lined up where he's going to be able to have this terrific amount of satellites that need to be launched. Let me drop it, see if there's any comments, questions. This is WS2N. Okay, no other comments. China is really getting involved with the private launches as well. They're building another launch complex down in China. There's like 5 different locations where China launches rockets. In fact, they led the world last year in the amount of rockets that took off. But now they want to have private companies. Well, they already have. They have 2 now. Private companies launching rockets from China. And it's one company. They were well on their way, they said, to launching a reusable rocket. You know, so, you know, they, everybody, you know, copies what we do. SpaceX has been doing it for quite a few years now. SpaceX is up to around 47 vehicles that they've recovered boosters successfully, either landed on land or landed on an autonomous ship out at sea. Now China wants to get into the act. And I saw an animation of what they plan on doing. Plan on launching a rocket, you know, it's got a booster, and then it has two, instead of solid booster rockets attached to it, two liquid fueled rockets that are going to act as boosters attached, you know, side by side to the main core. And then, of course, on top of that, you're going to have the second stage. On top of that, you're going to have your payload. So, you know, what they plan on doing is, like when SpaceX does it, they've done it three times. They'll launch a core vehicle, and then they have two side boosters. They call that the Falcon Heavy. And when that launches, the core stage goes out to sea and lands on a drone ship, and then the two boosters come back automatically and fly back to Cape Canaveral to landing zone one, and they land on solid ground. China has a little different view of what they're going to do. I don't think they're going to be able to do it, but they plan on launching the booster with the other two, you know, boosters side by side, and the one on the port side, one on the starboard side. They plan on taking off, and these boosters won't separate. They're not going to separate. They're going to stay attached to the vehicle. They'll all have fuel in it, and so all three are going to come down in, you know, one location onto a drone ship, you know. So they're going to take that same idea of the drone ship, but instead of separating the boosters, they want them to come down in one shot. Elon Musk said that it was very, very much more complicated. Like he was supposed to do it back in 2013, and he wasn't able to do it until February 6th of 2018. So that was like a 5-year delay. But I could imagine how complicated it would be to try to land on a drone ship. Three boosters, you know, completely attached, not even separating at one time. I don't think they're going to be able to do that anytime soon. So that's the story on China. So they're always trying to, you know, catch up. Actually, to some degree, they did. They launched more rockets than any one country did this year than anybody else. But nobody has the technology like we do, from what I think. Any questions or comments? This is WS2X. Not hearing any. I'm going to turn it over to Dick. I don't have any other topics. Unless people have questions, we'll have to come to a grinding halt for now. And if we do, happy holidays to everybody. And over to Dick, K2RIW. This is WS2N.
I'm not sure I caught everything, Paul. Is it true that the Chinese are thinking of having a first stage liquid fueled rocket with solid state boosters on the side, and they're thinking of keeping the solid state boosters attached and recovering all of that when it comes back down? And if that's true, I think that could be very inefficient, because the way the normal launch is done is you, after the solid rocket boosters burn out in about 2 minutes, you abandon those, you jettison those, and therefore the rest of the payload is a lot lighter and you get a lot more acceleration. So I think you lose a lot of efficiency if you left those solid boosters attached so that you think you can recover them. So did I misunderstand that? Is that what they're actually planning to do, Paul? WS2NK2RIW.
Yeah, of course, that's where the shuttle did. The solids came down in the ocean. Actually, they were reusable. They came down in parachutes. But they separated from the main vehicle. Delta IV, same thing. They used the RS-68 engines. They were liquid helium, liquid oxygen vehicle, and all three of them. And they would just waste the whole thing, you know. All three just went into the drink. SpaceX launches their heavy. They have the center booster, all liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen, and then they have the two side boosters. They weren't solid. They were liquid, exactly the same as the core, liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen. That would go up. First time they launched that was February 6th, 2018. They would separate the core, would be way downrange, so they couldn't bring that back to land. That would land on the drone ship all by itself, and the two side boosters would fly, do a flyback and come all the way back to Cape Canaveral and land independently all by themselves, and then all three would be reusable. They've done that launch three times and successfully saved some of the boosters, a couple of boosters. one time they landed one of them on a drone ship, and they were trying to bring it back, and the thing tipped over them and broke. they couldn't get it tied down to the deck fast enough because it was high seas. But they successfully landed on all three at one time. China decides, well, it's a private company anyway. I'm not sure about what they mean by private companies when it comes to China, but that's what they said. This private company wants to develop this rocket, and they have an animation of it. The boosts are going up, and then the two side boosters also probably be liquid fueled as well. Liquid fuel, liquid oxygen. So the whole setup would come back as one, not separate from one another. So, you know, you're going to have, you know, like 30% of the fuel probably left over, and all three boosters will land on a drone ship at the same time. I don't see that happening. I mean, it's not efficient, like you said, but at the same time, I don't think technically it's an easy job to do. Back to you.
A couple of times you've said tonight that the liquid-fueled rockets use liquid hydrogen, liquid helium. I think you mean liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, because I don't think helium can be used as a fuel. As a pressurization, yes, but not as a fuel. Minor mistake there, Paul. Yeah, as I said, you said that twice. Yeah, I think the boosters on the side should be jettisoned, unless they burn for the exact same period of time as the center one. There's a huge disadvantage of leaving them attached. Is that the way you see it also?
Exactly. Yeah, well, it's getting late. they do have helium, but not for that reason. Like you said, the helium, it keeps it pressurized so that the tanks don't, they tend to collapse. They're actually balloon skin tanks, you know, without that extra helium pressure going into it. Some of the, like the second stage would start to collapse. They have helium on the second stage on Falcon 9. But yes, the Falcon 9 has kerosene. It's liquid kerosene chilled down to like super very cold temperatures. Densification, they call it. So that's how they launch their rockets with, of course, liquid oxygen. The RS-68 engines by the Delta IV rocket that goes up either by itself or with the side-by-side boosters, also Delta IV rockets are liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. That's what I meant to say. Just like the shuttle, the shuttle engines, the RS-25 engines, the three engines, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And when you get to the space shuttle system, that's going to have the exact same engines. They'll be using those engines from the shuttle, except instead of three engines, they'll be using four, and again, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And that's it. There's so many different combinations. You have Northrop Grumman. They're going to build an all-solid booster rocket launcher, payloads to orbit. Eventually, they want to put a crew vehicle on top of it, we got a lot of combinations going here, Dick.
Yeah, but a solid booster is not controllable. You can't control the thrust. You can't turn it off once you turn it on. So some huge disadvantages there. When you're supercooling the kerosene as fuel, and the fuel, I think, is pumped through the piping on the rocket engine itself to keep it from melting. So the super-cooled kerosene, is that going to those pipes on the rocket engine along with maybe the liquid oxygen? Are both going through all those pipes acting as coolant before they actually get burned in the chamber of U-Bolt K2LIW?
All the designs I've seen, it's the liquid fuel that either is piped around the engines and sometimes around the cone of the engine. Sometimes the cones are, the exhausts are like double walled, and they have to, again, like you said, liquid fuel running sometimes through the walls of the nozzles. So yeah, there's different configurations like that. And I was going to say something. Oh, yeah, about the solid booster rockets. Yeah, that's... That's all solid. It's going to be five sections eventually put together. And that's all derived from the space shuttle. The space shuttle, you had two solids, one on one side, one on the other. Each one producing like 3 million pounds of thrust. And that a company had taken that and they designed the Ares rocket. Ares was fired off once, and then they abandoned that idea. And then from that has come it's still on the drawing boards. They've developed that further. His names have changed from one to the other over the years. And now Northrop Grumman has it, and they're developing the Omega rocket. Probably within, I'm going to say 2021, will be their first launch. It's a large rocket from Launch Complex 39B. And that one will launch rockets for the defense, at Pentagon. But someday in the future, they have plans on putting a crew on top of that. So that would be on top of a solid booster rocket. And like you said, you light it off and, you're done. But they did that with the shuttle. I mean, those boosters went off. The second they were lit, it was either they were going to blow up or they were going to make it to orbit.
Your commercial businesses that are in the listing and rocket business these days, SpaceX and Boeing and whatever, it seems like they're, I guess it was Elon Musk, maybe is one of the first guys who brought the lower boosters back down and landed them, and now everybody's bringing back almost all of their boosters. NASA never brought any of their boosters back to re-land. They just lowered them on parachutes. Is that true, Paul? K2LIW?
NASA was instrumental in developing it. Back in the 90s, they had the Delta Clipper. They called it the Delta Clipper. They managed to get it up to around 10,000 feet. So they would launch it. I think that was out in New Mexico they were testing on. Well, they launched it It will go up and have four legs on it, and it will come back and land vertically. So they started the development of it, and they got to a point where one of the legs broke, the whole thing fell over, and you know, NASA just bailed out of that program. But Elon Musk eventually took that design, or took that idea anyway, and he ran with it, and he's the first one. Well. Yeah, he's the first one to get one back from orbit safely. You know, launch something to orbit, and the first stage, of course, when we get it through all orbit, that would get up to around 3,000-4,000 miles an hour, and eventually they brought those first stages back. Now, Jeff Bezos of Amazon launches the new Shepard on a regular basis, and he launches that suborbital flight. It does make it to space. And then the vehicle comes, the booster, well, the main rocket itself comes back and lands vertically. So he's doing that. And the next one on the list that we're going to see again in about 2 years, again, will be Jeff Bezos of Amazon, which is, you know, subsidiary of Amazon is Blue Origin, so they're the ones that launch the new Shepard suborbital ones, and they're also the one that will be launching the new Glenn from Launch Complex 36 down in Florida. They've taken it over. I mean, I've seen pictures of this place. It looks like a bigger launch complex than what SpaceX built. So they're really making a big, massive project out of Launch Complex 36. NASA turned it over to Blue Origin. So they'll be launching New Glenn, and that will be an orbital vehicle. I mean, massive. I mean, if you look at it, it looks like it's almost the same size of a Saturn V rocket, and that booster itself will be coming back and landing on their own drone ship that they're building. So, you know, that's another one. Peter Beck with Rocket Lab launches the Electron probably within a year. We'll be recovering his boosters, but differently. He's going to be catching them out of the sky with the helicopter. Of course, those boosters are nowhere near as big as what, you know, Falcon 9 with Elon Musk or the new Glenn with Blue Origin is going to be using. But still, they'll be recovering them. Back to you, Dick.
Recovering with a helicopter sounds very difficult. All right. Those rotary blades, and I have to miss everything, you know, the parachute and the vehicle and so on. So I presume they carry some kind of a net behind the helicopter in order to capture the thing coming back down. Is that what's planned to be done? That's question number one. And question number two, of all the recoveries that have been done where the rocket comes back down and lands, the lower booster comes back down and lands, obviously that's to save money and you can reuse it. What's the maximum number of times any one recovered, you know, landed tail first, what's the maximum number of times any one of those to date has ever been reused? Paul, go ahead.
Four times. The final version of the Falcon 9 was started about a year ago. Started flying, and it's called the Block 5. Block 4s were reusable just once. They could have used it three times, but they never did. The Block 5 is the final version that could be used up to 10 different times. They've had one that's been reused four times already. And they can go up to 10 times, and then at that point, he says he would do a major overhaul on them and then do it again for another 10 times and theoretically launch one booster 100 times. Right now he's up to four.
And I presume it's the main engine and the pumps that have to be refurbished. Is that what has the most wear and tear?
Not at all. The plumbing sometimes might be damage or something. He's got a heat shield in there, but his theory is that he could land this thing like a jet and refuel it and let it go again, you know, 10 times in a row. But after 10 times, then I guess, you know, break everything down and, you know, start all over again, but he'd be able to reuse his, everything over and over again. That's his goal, and that's what he says he could do with these Black Fives. Look at the time. I got 2 minutes left. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Good stuff. Okay, 73-year-old. That's the end of tonight, and I'll turn it back to Roy in case he wants to reissue his addresses as he usually does. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick, and as always, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, for the technical net, and you can't get on the tech net, or if you have any information you'd like me to pass to Paul, or if you would like to suggest a topic, subject, puzzler, or refute something that I said, the email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all of the stories and some of the interesting visual articles that I thought might amuse some people will be posted, already are posted, on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. My call sign is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. And as always, thanks to Dick for giving me the opportunity to do this on a weekly basis, and thanks to everyone who participated. And wish for everyone a happy Hanukkah, a Merry Christmas, and a happy and healthy New Year. This is AC2GS, and I'll be clear.
Bye-bye, you guys. Be kind to each other. K2RIW clear.
Hey, Dick, can I say something? M2EO before PD shuts off.
Go ahead, Rich.
Hopefully we'll be back next week, and then we'll be talking about New Year's. Happy holidays, guys.
Yes, happy holidays. Dick, before the repeater goes on, I wanted to say, in the new year, I wish everybody well, and thank you to animals. I adopted Marshmallow, the cat, this past June. His birthday, I called the ASPCA, was March 25th. So thank you to animals. They're out on the street. They rescue these shelters, rescue the animals. Think of adopting a cat or a dog. They're very friendly. A cat is no trouble to take care of. If anybody is interested, call me. Telephone number 631-855-6425. I can tell you ways to take care of a cat. It makes it very simple to clean up the litter box and feed them. And they're very pleasant to have around. So give me a call if you're interested. I can steer you in the right place where to get a pet. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Rich. I've already got 2 cats. Bye-bye, you guys.
So you're a cat lover, Dick. Thank you.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.